welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden years. Mark Levonier, your host for an hour of true history. Later on, a moment from the Behind the Mic series. Also, We the People from 1945 with a salute to the Red Cross. But right now, the sixth program in a series of broadcasts produced by the Warshipping Administration in 1945 called Heroes of the Merchant Marine. In this episode, a salute to Gus Warren Darnell, the captain of the SS Cardonia.
Heroes of the Merchant Marine. Heroes of the Merchant Marine, the thrilling true stories of men who are heroes aboard ship. A program salute to the men who serve and live for their country by sailing the world's seaways to deliver to our troops and allies the vital supplies of a victorious new world. Heroes of the Merchant Marine is a series of programs dedicated to America's brave merchant seamen, the everyday common men who are heroes every day they sail the pathways of the world. These are true stories narrated by Ray Lewis and transcribed from the confidential files of the War Shipping Administration. The inspiring story of Captain Gus Warren Darnell. Here is Ray Lewis.
This is about a man whose life was the sea. He spent his life on the sea, and he had earned the rank of Master Mariner on the sea. Captain Gus Darnell not only loved the sea and knew all there was to know about ships, but he also knew men, for he was a leader of men, as this true story proves. He was a quiet man by nature, but he loved a good joke. And back home in Houston, Texas, he enjoyed treating his wife and neighbors to the fine repertoire of sea stories he collected during his many voyages around the world. His blue eyes twinkled and his ruddy face wrinkled in a happy grin when he'd tell his stories to the neighbors. But on the bridge of his ship, his eyes took in everything with just a businesslike, matter-of-fact glance. And his men, seeing him up there on the bridge, went about their business confidently. Because Captain Darnell knew what it was all about. He knew the sea and ships and men. He was a good captain to sail with. It was during the very early days of the war, and Captain Darnell was on his way to the South Pacific with precious supplies that were vitally needed by our troops. His ship was the SS Cardonia, and it had been his ship for a number of years. He knew its every part, its every piece of machinery, its every gauge. For it was his ship, from stem to stern, from funnel to engine room. It was dawn, and the Cardonia was only a few days from its destination. Captain Darnell had just come onto the bridge when suddenly the lookout called,
"Submarine, up the starboard beam!"
Captain Darnell sounded general quarters and looked toward the starboard. Yes, there it was, a telltale feathery wake that announced a black, slimy visitor, a coy visitor that cared to show only her periscope and nothing else. But that was enough.
Captain, she's fired a torpedo. It's
hard left rudder, helmsman.
Aye, sir.
The ship slowly swings to the left as the torpedo churns a straight line toward her.
Missed, sir. They missed. Inches.
just by inches, sir.
Good work, Larson. Straighten her out.
This is tricky business. Very tricky business. An unarmed merchant ship trying to outmaneuver torpedoes. One man in a big cargo-heavy ship against a sub full of torpedoes. And this one man has to outguess the sub. The odds are long. Too long.
Helmsman, red rudder.
Aye, sir.
Torpedo, sir, off port bow. Another one missed, sir. We're...
Lucky. Too lucky, helmsman. Swing her around. Full right rudder. We'll have to run for it. Full speed, Larson.
The Cardonia swings around, and the loaded merchant ship tries to run from the sub.
Submarine surface off stern!
That means they'll shell us as we run, helmsman. Full speed, Larson. Everything you got. Pour it on. The sub's right behind us. We'll be shelled any minute.
I'm giving her all she'll hold, sir.
Are you hurt, helmsman?
No. No, sir. We only have half a roof, sir.
No use changing course. They're right behind us. Just keep straight ahead. Maybe they'll run out of shells.
The race was on. One of the most one-sided races in the history of the sea. The surface Jap sub, only a few hundred yards behind the unarmed, desperately plodding cargo ship. Unable to stop the rain of shells from the sub's deck cannon. More than an hour of constant shelling. Fatal, maddening shelling. More than an hour. Almost an eternity for Captain Darnell as he watched his ship being gradually blown from under him. A fire, the first of many, was started on the lower deck, and it was blazing furiously. The entire superstructure was a mass of debris and flames. Another fire raged along the sides, burning almost every one of the ship's lifeboats. Fire below decks, turning the engine room into an inferno. And finally...
Sir, the steering gear won't work. Won't work, sir.
Captain Darnell looked about him, and his ship was a terrible, burning, broken mockery of what had once been the SS Cardonia. His ship was a flaming mass of debris. There was nothing else to do but...
Abandon the ship.
Abandon ship. All hands, abandon ship.
What was left of the crew gathered at the side, near the only lifeboat left by the Jap sub. Three life rafts were filled with men and lowered safely over the side. The remaining 23 seamen crowded into the one lifeboat, Captain Darnell aboard, and they began their descent from what had been the Cardonia to the sea. But the Japs had one last finishing touch to add to the little drama. Just one last finishing touch. A fine sense of humor. Their last departing shell hit the fuel tank, and the men in that crowded, lowering lifeboat were showered with burning oil. Captain Darnell jumped to the lifeboat's ropes.
Cut the lines! Dooley, cut our lines right now!
The captain and another man immediately cut the lifeboat's lines, and the ship dropped with a heavy crash onto the rough sea. The sudden drop had snuffed out the flames of the oil that showered the men. The exploding fuel tank had killed one man. The rest were safe. By letting the lifeboat drop to the sea from the deck of the burning Cardonia, Captain Darnell had saved 25 lives. The men looked about them. The Cardonia wouldn't last 5 more minutes. The wind was pushing them away from the boat. The sub had disappeared. It had done its work. There were only the 3 life rafts drifting away from the crowded lifeboat. The sharp wind, the rough, shifting sea, and the Cardonia sinking fast. Soon the burned, shattered hull disappeared beyond the horizon as the lifeboat drifted with the wind. But Captain Darnell gazed in the direction of his dead, unseen ship for long minutes afterward. The 23 men in his boat also looked toward the spot where they knew that their ship was being buried by an angry sea. But even if his ship were dead, he was still captain. And Master Mariner Gus Darnell proved his seamanship once more. He set sail for the nearest land and broke the long silence with...
Men, if my calculations are right, there's a small piece of land about 30 miles from here, and we're going to make that island before the sun goes down. If the Lord is with us...
Just as Captain Darnell promised, Land was sighted that afternoon. Good, solid, unsinkable land. Wearily, the 23 men got out of the battered lifeboat and waded ashore, most of them dropping exhausted on the first piece of dry land their feet had touched since leaving the States. Then some of them noticed that the captain hadn't left the lifeboat. He whispered something in the first mate's ear. The mate nodded, and then they prepared to shove off again. Captain Darnell turned to his men there on the island beach.
Men, somebody has to find the boys who've drifted away on those life rafts. Somebody has to guide them to this island. The mate's agreed to go with me, so we'll be back in a few hours.
With that, Captain Darnell shoved off again into the rough sea, with darkness closing in on them, with only hope and luck to aid them, searching for those three lost rafts that had been drifting for hours. But no matter. They were his crew, and he owed them his duty. And he would have continued his search till he found them, had not a Navy cutter come along with the good news that the men had already been found. Only then did Captain Gus Darnell stop his search and begin thinking about his next ship. Yes, he was a good captain to sail with. When the President of the United States awarded him the Merchant Marine Distinguished Service Medal, this citation read:
To Gus Warren Darnell, Master Mariner, for distinguished service in enemy action. Attacked by an enemy submarine, he so skillfully maneuvered his ship as to cause two torpedoes to miss. As his ship was unarmed, he attempted to run from the submarine, which was also attacking by gunfire at close range. For over an hour, he strove to outdistance the foe. Only when enemy shells had started two serious fires, wrecked the superstructure, demolished all but one of the lifeboats, and so disabled the steering gear that the ship was out of control, did he reluctantly give orders to abandon ship. The only usable lifeboat had been punctured by shell fragments, and while engaged in lowering away, a shell hit the fuel tank and showered the crew with burning oil. Yet he so expertly supervised this operation that all but one of his crew got safely away, with 22 men crowded into the boat and the remainder distributed on three life rafts. He set sail for the nearest land, 30 miles away, disembarked most of the men, and endeavored to set out again into a heavy sea for the men left on the life raft. Only when assured that these men had been rescued by a naval vessel did he cease his determined efforts to go to their assistance. His expert ship handling, his courageous leadership, and his fine concern for the safety of his crew were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Merchant Marine. For the President, signed Emery Scott Land, Chairman.
Captain Gus Darnell, which you have just heard, was one in a series of Heroes of the Merchant Marine, program salutes to our brave merchant seamen as transcribed from the confidential files of the War Shipping Administration.
Heroes of the Merchant Marine, on Tuned to Yesterday, Episode 6 in that series from 1945. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now on to the human interest show, We the People, part of CBS Radio's Sunday morning lineup at 10:30. At the point of this broadcast, it had been on the air for about 9 years. An amalgam of stories next, including a Red Cross salute from June 24th, 1945.
Gulf Oil Companies and your neighborhood Good Gulf dealer present We the People with music by Oscar Bradley's orchestra. This is Milo Bolton welcoming you to We the People for Gulf Oil. What real experiences of real people will you hear tonight? Well, here is a sample of what those people will tell you.
I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen the miracle of 44th Street myself.
It's a simple dream, I guess, but it's won other battles, and it'll win this war.
I fought my way through a forest filled with mustard gas.
You'll never know if the flak hits us. We're carrying 2 tons of dynamite.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you'll hear the stories behind these dramatic statements and other real experiences of real people that you meet only when the Gulf Oil Companies and your neighborhood Good Gulf dealer present We the People. C-47 streaks through enemy skies and swoops low over the Philippines. Altitude, 600 feet. Mission, delivery of Red Cross supplies by parachute.
Well, man, you may be Red Cross officials just along for the ride, but you're taking the place of a couple of men, so you'll have to work.
Well, I guess we can meet a little Jap flag if you can. Oh, boy, here it comes all around us.
Hey, let's get started. What are we dropping?
Coffee, sugar, cream, tobacco, and chocolate bars. Usual things, except for that big package over there.
What's that?
Don't worry. If the flag gets it, you'll never know the difference. It's just a couple of tons of dynamite.
Yes, dropping dynamite along with Red Cross supplies was just one of the many hazards in the job of Gulf Oil's first guest, the only Red Cross field director actually to parachute in combat with his unit in the Pacific. He is Harold Templeman of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Mr. Templeman, before you tell us how you came to be a Red Cross paratrooper, what about those 2 tons of dynamite?
Well, Milo, the day before I left the Philippines to come home, we flew a special load of supplies to the men at the front. A couple of visiting Red Cross officials decided to go along for the ride, but they got the surprise of their life when they discovered that the Army had tucked in a little dynamite with the coffee and donuts.
Well, Harold, tell us how you happened to join the paratroopers.
In January 1944, I joined the 503rd Parachute Infantry in my regular capacity as a Red Cross worker, but it wasn't until 6 weeks later that I really became part of the outfit.
What happened in that 6 weeks?
I went into jump training with the men, and boy, it sure was tough for an old man. You know, Milo, I'm 40 years old. But the boys were very solicitous about the old man. They wanted me to stick it out. Mostly, I guess, because they liked the idea of hot coffee and donuts going in with them.
And you went into combat with the men?
Yes, Milo. After I received my wings, our first objective was Noom Four Islands in Dutch New Guinea. But the jump at Corregidor was the one I'll always remember. I jumped there in the fifth plane the first wave. And that was some jump. Nothing below but rock and more rock. We had a spot just 300 yards long to drop in, and if we didn't hit it, it was just too bad. After jumping, we dropped about 4 tons of supplies. It was the first time that Red Cross bundles had traveled with the paratroopers.
Well, with all those supplies, you must have been able to set up your canteen fairly soon, huh?
Not right away, Milo. My first job was to give any comfort I could to the wounded. Then, with the Japs still pouring fire down on us, we scrambled out and recovered every Red Cross bundle of food and drink. And from then on, the canteen was open day and all night. Nobody rested. But the great day came when General MacArthur returned to the Rock.
Did you meet him?
Yes. He stopped at the canteen for something cool to drink. It was one of the greatest thrills in my life. For when he left, General MacArthur turned and saluted me, just as if I were a fighting man, too.
And we the people salute you, Harold Templeman. And all the fearless men and women of the American Red Cross who day and night devote themselves to the comfort and safety of our fighting forces. You know, friends, years ago, before the war, there used to be quite a lot of backseat driving.
For instance, when I used to take out our family car, my wife used to say things like this.
Now, do be careful, Milo. This is a new car, you know.
Well, today a lot of things have changed, even backseat driving. Now it goes like this.
Be extra careful, Milo. This is an old car, you know.
Yes, friends, things have changed, especially automobiles. They're really old. That's why it's good to remember this.
To help your car run better longer, rely on your Gulf dealer and his protective maintenance services. For instance, he's ready with superior lubrication, his Gulf Pride and Gulf Flex treatment. Gulf Pride, the world's finest motor oil, will protect your motor extra well thanks to an extra refining method that Gulf alone uses. And Gulf Flex lubrication means scientific, long-lasting protection for vital wearing points in the chassis and body of your car. To get that Gulf Pride and Gulf Flex treatment, and to get all your Gulf dealer's other protective maintenance services, drive in at the sign of the Gulf Orange Disc. For the life of your car, go Gulf.
The scene, the stage door canteen, 44th Street, New York City. The time, just a few Saturday nights ago. The canteen is crowded with men just back from overseas, others about to go over, but all of them with the same idea, to have a good time, and this is their night. Attractive young girls wearing ribbons marked hostess are busy seeing the men get refreshments, dancing with them, and sometimes just sitting and talking with a lonely soldier or sailor. Up near the dance floor, a soldier named Al sits and taps his foot in rhythm with the music. His crutches are lying alongside his chair, and he watches a sailor jitterbugging out on the crowded dance floor. Al tries to remember the last time he jitterbugged. He wonders when the next time might be. And that's the beginning of one of the most unusual stories to yet come out of this war. Right now at our We the People microphone to tell you the rest of the story is that soldier named Al. PFC Al Cohen of Bayonne, New Jersey. Suppose you pick it up where I left off, Al.
Well, like you said, Milo, I was sitting there watching the dancing and talking to my buddies. There were some other fellows with me. You see, we had come up from the Woodrow Wilson General Hospital in Virginia, and we're on our way to the hospital at Camp Upton.
Well, how long ago has it been since you were wounded, Al?
About 8 months. I got it last November near Prüm, Germany. A Nazi shell blew up near me, sending shrapnel into my legs and stomach. Well, after we got off the train from Virginia that Saturday night, we had a few hours to kill before catching the train out to Upton. We decided to go over to the stage door canteen and spend the time. While I was sitting there, one of the hostesses came over to our table and sat down, and we began to talk. She's here with me now, Milo, and I'd like we the people to meet her. She's Marjorie Greenstein of Brooklyn.
Hello, Marjorie.
Hello, Milo.
Well, Al, what happened after Marjorie joined you at the table?
Well, maybe Margie had better tell you.
Well, when I first came over, Milo, we just talked. But when the music started to get going again, Al started jiving around in his chair. I looked at him and then at his crutches. I guess we were both thinking the same thing.
That's right, Milo. I sure wanted to dance. And I guess Margie did, too. But I guess we both decided at the same time, without saying anything, that dancing was just impossible.
But, Al, you kept tapping your feet and swaying to the music, and I just had to say something.
And she sure did, too, Milo.
What did she say, Al?
Out of a clear sky, she said, "Let's dance." Well, I didn't know what to do. It all seemed so strange, and I couldn't make myself believe it would be possible. I didn't think I'd even be able to walk for many months. But then Margie leaned over and said, "I may have a weak mind, Al, but I have a strong back. I'll hold you up." Well, I can't explain what went on inside me, but I stood up, and before I knew it, we were dancing.
Well, now, wait a minute. You mean you thought you couldn't even walk without your crutches, and you actually got up and danced?
Well, sort of, Milo. I was a little wobbly, but Margie did have a strong back.
I guess we did stumble a bit, but Al, you really came through. You know, Marlo, he even wanted a jitterbug. And I guess Al and I were both surprised that he could dance. But when he got back to the table, you should have seen the expressions on the faces of his buddies. And before he left that night, he gave me a present I'll never forget.
What was it, Marjorie?
Al walked up to me and said, "Thanks." And then he handed me his crutches and walked out. Over at the canteen, we call it the miracle of 44th Street.
Thank you.
Our scene is a schoolroom set right in the heart of the busy New York Navy Yard in Brooklyn. A group of sailors are lounging on the wooden benches, shooting the breeze, much as students do everywhere on the first day of school.
Hey, what's this chemical war stuff we gotta learn?
Now, you take it from me, the course isn't gonna be any pipe. Look at all the bottles of poison gas, and see them charts there in the gas mask.
Oh, I bet the guy that teaches this is plenty tough.
The name on the door is McAllister. Probably a sourpuss who cracks you down and doesn't know when to let a guy go out for a blow.
Yeah.
Good morning, men. I'm McAllister. Chemical war instructor.
Hey, look at that. A dame.
You can't blame those sailors for being surprised. For Pretty Wave Lieutenant Mary Margaret McAllister is the first woman teacher of chemical warfare in the country. Right now, Lieutenant McAllister is standing by a We the People microphone set up outside the gas chamber in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Come in, Lieutenant McAllister.
Good evening, Mr. Bolton. I've just come out of the gas chamber where I've been getting the gas ready for our test tonight.
Well, Lieutenant, before you proceed, will you tell us how you happened to become interested in the chemical warfare branch of the Navy?
That's the same question the officer at the chemical warfare school at Edgewood Arsenal asked me. He tried to convince me that the arsenal with its live mustard gas and its land minefields was no place for a girl. But of all the jobs in the Navy, that was the one I had my heart set on.
Well, did you take the same course that the men did?
Yes, I took the course with the men. There were 80 of us in the class. I'll never forget one day on maneuvers when we were taken to a forest sprayed with live mustard gas. Gas was literally dripping off the trees. Our job was to clear a 100-foot path through there. Well, we were all dressed alike in protective suits and with gas masks. I was working away with a shovel when somebody tapped me on the shoulder, handed me an axe, and motioned for me to get to work on that tree stump that needed removing.
Did you do it?
I wouldn't be here at Brooklyn Navy Yard today if I hadn't done it.
Well, Lieutenant, what does your course in chemical warfare consist of?
I teach the crews of ships headed for the Pacific how to detect poison gases and how to give first aid to shipmates who may be injured by them. I train the men to get their masks on within 9 seconds. The men who are taking part in the demonstration tonight are from the carrier Franklin, and this will be their first contact with gas. They haven't handled a gas mask before under gas, and so they may not get the mask on as rapidly as they should.
What kind of gas is in the chamber tonight?
Tear gas, and it can make a man very unhappy if he doesn't follow instructions.
All right, Lieutenant McAllister, proceed with the demonstration.
Now hear this. When I give the command, gas, you will enter the gas chamber without your gas mask on. You will put the mask on as soon as entering, according to instructions. All right, men, gas. Ladies and gentlemen, the men are entering the chamber now. Their hats are on and their masks are inside the kits they're carrying slung over their shoulders. Now all the men are inside the chamber. The door is shut tight. There's a window in the chamber, and I can see them standing inside. They're all getting their masks out of their kits. The men don't look very happy in there, but it's necessary that they go through this test before they head for the Pacific. If the time should ever come when they had to face a deadly gas at the hands of the enemy, they'd be glad for having had this experience. One of the men is crying. Tears are running down his cheeks, and he's trying desperately to get the mask on. There, he has it on now. All of the men have their masks on. It took them only 11 seconds. But that's 2 seconds too long if there were blood and nerve poison in there. The men are walking around in the chamber. One of them's tugging at a head strap. Evidently, the mask isn't on tight enough. A lucky thing there's tear gas in there and not one of the dangerous blister gases. Now I'm going to step away from the window and out into the wind. Here come the men out of the chamber now. They're certainly getting their masks off fast. Maybe you can hear them coughing. Tear gas isn't pleasant, you know. Now the men are flopping their clothes in the wind. I guess we can go up close enough to talk to them without getting too much of it ourselves. Locke, how was it in the chamber?
It's pretty rugged. It's pretty hard on the eyes and burns your neck pretty much.
Hollinger, what was the odor of the gas?
Tastes like apple blossom to me.
How did you like it, Rayford?
Crying like a baby.
Mr. Bird, what happened to you in the chamber?
Well, my face is burning pretty well. My neck, my eyes, got me really crying now.
How are you feeling, Grafham?
Well, it isn't too bad when you come out and look at a pretty girl like you.
Thank you, men. Dismissed.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant McAllister, for that most interesting demonstration of chemical warfare training. I first heard we were going to have Lee Carson on Gulf Oil's We the People, I figured she'd be tough and masculine and pretty rugged. You see, Miss Carson was the first woman war correspondent ever assigned to a combat unit, and she was assigned to the First Army. I'd heard how Lee Carson pounded her typewriter under rifle and mortar fire, ack-ack and buzz bombs, and dug herself a foxhole every night before turning in. Well, I got the surprise of my life. She has wavy red hair that hangs to her shoulders, green eyes, full red lips, and, well, fellas, she's the typical G.I. pinup girl. Feminine and really something to look at. Come right on out here on stage, Lee.
Thank you, Milo, and thanks very much for the build-up.
You're welcome.
When I first went up to the front, the GIs used to ask, "Lady, what the blazes are you up here for?" And there's only one answer, and I gave it. I'm up here because you are. They accepted that. Then, what's more, they figured, my golly, if the dame's up here, things couldn't be so bad after all.
Well, then you got along pretty well with the troops.
Oh, sure. To the GI, I represented that other almost forgotten world of the American girl. And they have a very special feeling for correspondents. They want people back home to know what they're doing and how tough it is. It's very hard to die anonymously. The presence of a correspondent at the front lets a little light into that very narrow world of sweating out being killed. You sort of become part of their outfit, Myra.
Well, I understand that you covered the European battle from the invasion of Normandy right up into Germany on VE Day. You must have had a lot of close calls during that time, Lee.
Well, a few from time to time, Milo. And I guess I owe my life to the frontline does. They certainly taught me how not to get killed. When I went ashore in Normandy, I was green, and the reason I didn't get killed was pure luck. Later, the GIs taught me the art of staying alive, like identifying outgoing and incoming shell fire or how to locate where small arms fire is coming from. And they taught me when it's safer to keep going than to stop and hit the dirt. And I got to know if the town we were entering was empty or full of Germans. It makes a lot of difference.
Yeah, I think it would. You certainly have had a great deal of excitement, Lee. But what do you think was your most exciting experience?
Well, that's hard to say. D-Day, the breakthrough at Saint-Lô, Paris, up into Germany. But the day we met the Russians is still vivid in my mind because it's recent. We've been watching and waiting for a week. Our daily sport was going up in Piper Cub to locate the heads of the oncoming Russian columns. When we finally met them, they were excited as we were. The Russians gave away all their medals, and the Americans gave away all their wristwatches. Terrific conversations went on all the time. The Russians talking in Russian and the Americans in English. No one understood each other, but that didn't stop anybody. One expression we all learned was, German kaput. Germany finished. Then everybody would laugh and shake hands and pound each other on the back. Well, as a matter of fact, I was proud to be there with those hard-fighting kids of the First Army. For we all knew that this meeting marked the real end of the war in Europe.
Well, thank you, Lee Carson. Oh, what are your plans for the future?
Well, right now I'm writing a book, Milo, and when I finish that, well, I've never been out to the Pacific, and there's a war to be finished. Thank you.
You know that in another 12 months, we expect to have over 1 million new cars on the road. But I wonder if you know this.
In spite of all those new cars, next year there may be fewer cars running than there are now. Because it's estimated that in the next 12 months, nearly 1.5 million old cars may go off the road. And since cars today are wearing out so rapidly, why not depend on your Gulf dealer's protective maintenance services to help your car keep on running? For instance, for the chassis of your car.
Get Gulf Flex lubrication. When your car is Gulf Flexed, vital wearing points in body and chassis are scientifically lubricated with specialized Gulf Flex lubricants.
And for the motor of your car,
get Gulf Pride, the world's finest motor oil. Gulf Pride gives extra protection thanks to an extra and exclusive Gulf refining method, the famous Alclor process.
Your Gulf dealer can also give your car his complete cooling system service. He can check your tires, service your battery, change your gear lubricants, and perform other needed services. Telephone your Gulf dealer for an appointment tomorrow to get his protective maintenance services. For the life of your car, go Gulf.
At our Gulf Oil microphone now is a young fellow who joined the Navy 3 years ago in search of adventure. But before he was discharged a few months ago, he had fully learned the meaning of that word. He's Leroy Cole of Washington, D.C., and he wears battle stars for 4 major battles on his Asiatic campaign ribbon. And as for the adventure he found, well, suppose we let Leroy Cole tell the story.
Well, Milo, I thought I was getting adventure when I was in this combat beach party. That's an outfit that goes ashore in the second or third wave with the Army or Marines. We went ashore in Pililou, and there were plenty of snipers on the beach. It was hard for us to work because they were trying to pick off our men. So 5 of us volunteered to go in and pick off the snipers. Soon the shellfire began to come in pretty heavy, and we pushed deeper into the jungle. That's when the real adventures began. It was night, and we couldn't get back, so we dug foxholes and took a rest. We were pretty far away from our troops by then. The next morning, we tried to make our way back, but the Japs made it pretty hot for us. One of my buddies was killed, and there were 4 of us left. We were forced back and lost our sense of direction. We found ourselves low on rations, and after we lost track of the days, we had nothing left to eat.
Well, how long were you lost?
I think about 20 days.
Well, what did you do for food all that time, Roy?
We killed some Japs and got their rations. But it wasn't much. Hard biscuits and cooked dried rice. We were about half dead, and then another one of our buddies was picked off. There were only 2 of us left when we were rescued.
Well, Leroy, that jungle experience must have given you enough adventure for a lifetime.
It certainly did, Milo. But it wasn't the kind of adventure I was looking for. That kind doesn't exist in modern war. When I first joined up, I didn't know what war was. Tarawa woke me up. It was the most exciting thing I ever saw, and at first I was too fascinated to be scared. But that feeling soon passed. I was ordered to go in with medical supplies, and that's when I saw what war was like. Dead men lying on the beach. Men lying over barbed wire and Jap pill boxes lined up one next to another. It was plenty tough, but we got ashore and took Tarawa.
Well, Leroy, you certainly look awfully young to have had all those experiences.
That's just the trouble, Milo. I was young, and the Navy found it out. And then when I was discharged. You see, I joined the Navy when I was 14.
14? Well, I suppose now that you've gone through 3 years of Pacific battles, you're ready to take it easy.
Not by a long shot, Milo. I'm 17 now and waiting to be drafted.
If we the people could look at this present war 100 years from tonight, what would we find? What questions would we ask? Suppose we take our microphone into the future, into the mind of a man in the year 2045, and see what he would ask about this fight that we, the people, are carrying on against the enemy tonight.
The greatest war and the last war recorded in history. Millions fell on strange battlefields for a cause of which they could not be sure. Why? Why did the little man, the nobody who hated war, fight? For the belief of 4 world freedoms, then only inscribed on paper? For the words and ideals of statesmen? If not for these, why did men fight and die?
We the People's next guest is here tonight to answer these questions. His story is the story of millions of American combat soldiers. He is, in a sense, an unknown little man. Yet he is the most important man in the world today, for he is the conqueror of the Nazi war machine. Lieutenant Joseph B. Merrick, will you tell us your story?
Before I do, Milo, I want to say hello to the fellows at the Ashford General Hospital and out at Halloran. And I want to tell you how proud I am to be on this program tonight. Just a few months ago, I was almost entirely paralyzed from wounds received in action in Europe. Every Sunday night, after I got back to the States, I'd listen to you and your guests and We the People. Some of them had gone through so much more than I had that I found myself saying, if they can get well, I can too.
Well, how are you getting along now, Lieutenant?
Well, I still have to use a wheelchair to get around. But otherwise, I'm doing fine. And if there's any GIs listening whose vocal cords are paralyzed, I want you to say keep... I want to say keep fighting, fellas, because a couple of months ago, I couldn't make a sound. And now, I'm talking to millions of people.
And very ably, too, Lieutenant. But now, will you tell us what helped you keep going when things got tough?
Well, Milo, every tough, dirty-looking infantryman is fighting for someone he loves. When my outfit went into battle at St. Lo, I was thinking of a 9-pound newborn son who I've never seen. I was thinking of my little daughter, Kathy. How tough it had been to say goodbye to her and my wife. One night during a lull in the battle, I climbed into my foxhole and wrote a note to my little son, Joe. It wasn't a very good note because they were shelling us. My hands were trembling and it was muddy. I told him that it was too bad that I'd never gotten to know him and that his mother was the best and his sister was wonderful. I never got a chance to finish that note. Battles don't wait for a father to write notes to his son. After the breakthrough at St. Lo was over, we were all had a speaking acquaintance with the Lord, and most of us had become completely fatalistic. I kept saying to him, "Okay, Lord, if I get hit, it's your will, but you know how badly I'd like to get home."
Well, what happened then, Lieutenant?
They tell me that near Mortain, I was hit in the head by a shell fragment, which ripped into my brain. I was unconscious for 3 weeks. Now and then I came to and thought of my wife, and I said to myself, "Nancy, I'm going to be busy, and you'll have to run it alone." Well, after 2 months, I came home. A few weeks ago, I saw my family. When I first saw them, Kathy was in the bathtub with her hair pinned up, making eyes at me. And little Joe looked as though he was going to tear the bars off the crib. Nancy put them in the crib together, and they played like a couple of kittens. To see all of us together and to know that the victory in Europe is ours, it was then that I knew why I had fought. That's why I wrote an article for a magazine called Baby Talk. That's why I'm here tonight. I know that the four freedoms are fine dreams, and they will come true someday soon. But I have my dream, too. I dream about going to the beach and building sandcastles with my children, making an effort to resume a happy, normal, married life again. That's a pretty simple dream, I guess, but it's won battles, and it'll help to win this war. It can't miss, Milo. It can't miss.
We, the people, speak. This is Milo Bolton reminding you that next week at this same time, the Gulf Oil Companies and your neighborhood Good Gulf dealer will bring you another program of real people with real experience.
You'll hear two young cadet nurses with inspiring stories of their decisions to take up lives of sacrifice and service.
And with them will be Dr. Thomas Perrin, Surgeon General of the United States Public Health Service.
You'll also hear the brilliant young Warner Brothers star, Dane Clark, with a stirring and memorable message for all Americans.
And you'll hear the solution to one of the most baffling mysteries of the sea, the mystery of the SS City of Portland.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Dane Clark, Surgeon General Perrin, and many other real people with real experiences. Music for We the People is by Oscar Bradley. Mark it on your radio calendar now. Next week at this same time for We the People. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
We the People, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 24th, 1945, a CBS broadcast. Finally, in this hour of true history, an excerpt from the Graham McNamee-hosted program Behind the Mic, one of radio's great shows focusing in on its own business. Hobby Lobby's host Dave Ellman tells a great story next on the NBC Blue Network from November 17, 1940.
I've been in radio a long time, longer than I like to remember sometimes. And I've heard a lot of unusual stories about radio. But I don't think I ever heard a story as fantastic as the behind-the-mic story that will be told us by our next guest. And yet he assures me that every amazing detail of it is absolutely true. Our guest is Dave Ellman, whose new program, Contact, is fast growing in popularity. The story concerns an appearance on another delightful program of his, Hobby Lobby, a show which dealt with people's unusual hobbies. And here is the creator of that show, Dave Ellman. Hi, Dave. Exactly what was that fantastic story behind that appearance on your Hobby Lobby show?
Well, Graham, when I had been on the air with Hobby Lobby for just a week, a friend of mine called me on the telephone and gave me the telephone number of a woman who had a talking dog.
Did you say a talking dog?
Yes. So as soon as he hung up, I phoned the owner of the dog and I said to her, "Hello, this is Dave Ellman in New York. I've got a new radio program called Hobby Lobby."
"Yes, Mr. Ellman."
"I was told that you have a talking dog. Is that
yes,
so?"
"Yes, that's true."
"Well, it seems hard to believe. Would you mind putting the dog on the phone? I'd like to hear him talk."
"Just a minute. I'll call him to the phone and have him speak to you. Hirpint, Hirpint, speak."
"Hello."
"Hello."
"What?"
"Yes, that's the dog."
"Is that really a dog that talks?"
"It is. I'll have him say a few more words. Prince, say I love you."
"I love you."
"Say, I want you to come to New York and appear on my program next week." "I think that's the most amazing thing I ever heard." "Well, Graham, the mistress and her two dogs arrived in New York."
"Two dogs?"
"Yes, because she brought another dog along named Lady. She told me that Lady was Prince's closest companion and that Prince might not perform unless Lady was along. Well, I called up the newspaper and they sent reporters to my office to hear the dog. Oh, the dog really was wonderful. He talked beautifully."
"Now, Prince, come on. Say Aunt Nora. Come on. Say Aunt Nora. Prince. Aunt Nora.
Aunt Nora. Aunt Nora."
"Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful.
Gee, that was swell.
See, can I take
really
a picture?
Hey, can he talk enough for an interview?"
"Never can he talk."
Well, Prince was really in great form that day, but more and more reporters came into my office, and as they did, of course, the office naturally got hotter. Well, Prince suddenly stopped talking. His mistress explained that dogs perspire through their throats, and when the temperature of a room gets over 70 degrees, the perspiration in the dog's throat made it impossible for him to talk. Well, to cool the dog off, we tried ice water. Then someone suggested ice cream. We tried three different flavors. The only flavor he would eat at all was chocolate, and then he talked again. Well, as I said before, this was one of my first programs, and it was very important to me that everything go off successfully. Then, with the other dog, Lady, trailing along, we brought Prince over to rehearsal before the show and put him on a table before the microphone.
"Come on now. Talk, Princey. Come on."
"Nice, Princey. Come on, Princey. Talk. Say, are you sure that Lady's being here isn't disturbing him?"
"Oh, no. Princey likes Lady." "Quiet. Quiet, Lady. Quiet.
Maybe he doesn't like the shape of this microphone. Let's use this other mic over here. Maybe he'll like that. Come on over here, Princey.
Come on now.
Come on, talk.
Come on, Princey. Talk. Speak. Speak. Come on, speak."
"Well, I couldn't get that dog to talk at all, Graham, at the preliminary rehearsal. And then to make things more difficult, his mistress told me that we couldn't put him in front of an audience because he never worked before an audience before and would be scared. So at the last minute, we took Prince and his companion, Lady, into a small studio which we had air-conditioned so it would be under 70 degrees. It was so air-conditioned, I almost froze. Well, the time came for us to go on the air. That dog just had to talk or it would ruin my show. Finally, we got to Prince's spot, and I introduced him something like this. And now, ladies and gentlemen, you will hear this Daniel Webster of the doghouse, Prince." "Well, he's having a little difficulty. Maybe he doesn't want to talk until he sees his lawyer."
"Come on, Princey. Princey, say I love you. Princey, say I love you. Say I love you."
"Ladies and gentlemen, we seem to be having a little difficulty getting Princey to gab just now, but keep listening, and you'll hear him." Well, that room was ice cold, Graham, but I never sweated so much in my life. I could see the crumbling ruins of a perfectly good show, and then suddenly, to my amazement, his mistress turned to the other dog, who was also in the studio, and said,
"All right, Princey, since you won't talk, Lady will. Come on, Lady, now you talk. Say hello, Aunt Nora. Come on, Lady."
"Hello. Hello, Aunt Nora."
And so Graham, the stooge, who we never knew could talk, stood in for the star and spoke his lines instead. So just as we promised, We did have a talking dog on Hobby Lobby, even if it wasn't the one which was originally scheduled.
Well, thank you, Dave Ellman. That was a mighty good story. Thank you, and cold dog. What a story. Be sure to listen next week when Behind the Mic will bring back to you a few minutes of a favorite old program. Harry Horlick and the A&P Gypsies, with Harry Horlick himself conducting. And more of the human interest, the glamour, the comedy, the drama that are found behind the mic. This is Graham McNamee speaking. Good afternoon, all.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
An excerpt of Behind the Mic on Tuned to Yesterday from the 17th of November, 1940 on the NBC Blue Network. Wrapping up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levionier. It's been a pleasure.